Kia ora and welcome to another podcast in the intriguing series People, Places and the Climate Crisis, a series where I have the privilege of interviewing 16 outstanding climate experts on climate and local government in the lead up to the local body elections in October. I'm Lindsay Wood from the Resilience Climate Trust, and we are running this series in conjunction with Fresh FM, the top of the South's community access radio station. At the end of the podcast, I'll give you details of other ways you can listen if you wish. But now it's time for this interview with Cawthron Institute's freshwater ecology researcher, Dr. Simon Stewart. And Simon is speaking to us on the theme of regenerating nature. He's the first of two guests on this theme. The other is also a Simon Miller, Executive Director of Pure Advantage. Here's the conversation with Simon Stewart and me. I do hope that you enjoy it. Well, it's a great pleasure for me to welcome to this Climate Matters episode a neighbour and friend who's also a freshwater ecologist. Simon Stewart is a freshwater ecologist who looks at the flow of nutrients and energy in freshwater ecosystems. He works at the Cawthron Institute in Nelson. And Simon's background is that he did a master's at Canterbury University and then a PhD at Waikato. So welcome to this episode of Climate Matters and to talk about regenerating nature, Simon. It's just lovely to have you on the show.
Oh, kia ora, Lindsay. It's great to be here. Thanks.
I'm looking forward to our conversation. That's awesome. Let's start with the theme of regenerating nature and your speciality in freshwater ecosystems. I'm sure there's no shortage of places to turn your attention to, but I'm equally sure there are hosts of other aspects of the natural environment that also deserve regenerating. Plus, I imagine there's quite a difference between, for example, rural and urban environments. For this series, Connecting Climate and Local Government, can you please start by giving listeners and me a feel for the issues you'd like us to have in mind if we want to factor nature into our voting in October?
Yeah, sure thing. Well, I feel quite privileged in a lot of ways to be a freshwater ecologist in that, you know, in Aotearoa, freshwater ecology is, or our freshwater ecosystems have been first and foremost, I think, in a lot of our thinking and a lot of our political decisions, you know, definitely for the last decade or so. As a result, we have got the 2020 NPSFM National Policy Statement for Fresh Water. So we do have a fantastic framework for improving freshwater quality in New Zealand and places that are degrading and protecting those, you know, extremely beautiful systems that we do have. But it really does put the power, it gives a framework to the regional councils and it's how they implement it. And I think this is a really strong convergence with climate here. A recent paper was published last month by a broad suite of freshwater ecologists, and it was basically sounding the alarm or bringing back to people's attention the idea of the dual attack hypothesis. What is the fact that when we've got nutrient enrichment and climate change together, they act synergistically? If we think about it in terms of nitrogen, so, you know, the eutrophication potential of a kg of nitrogen, and if we raise the temperature by 2 degrees, that same kilogram of nitrogen, let's say, is going to be more potent. It's going to cause more ecosystem degradation. It's going to drive higher production rates. It's going to drive higher respiration rates than it would at 2 degrees lower. So although we've got a great opportunity, I think that we, you know, it is a time for being extremely cautious with the way in which we are implementing the NPSFM. And this is going to be driven by the councillors that we are electing to our councils. So it's a very important time, I think.
Oh, that's a wonderful opening to this interview, Simon. I picked up two sort of key points halfway through there. You used the lovely phrase about our beautiful ecosystems, and then you also said that the regulations put the power in the hands of the councils as to their management and well-being. So that really does focus on how our councils are up to that task, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I would like to now do what I've called a dive into the swamp with you. A recurring issue, as I understand it, and correct me if I'm wrong, is how we treat wetlands, their ecosystem functions and their potential for storing carbon. It seems to be an ongoing source of concern that we're still draining wetlands, sometimes to create marginally productive agricultural land. And yet I read recently that wetting them might turn them into great carbon sinks. Can you give some insights into the importance of wetlands, their current status nationally, and what roles councils might play in their protection and their recovery?
It's kind of funny talking about wetlands and swamps when it comes to politics, because I think of that famous saying, draining the swamp. And if we think about Donald Trump's attempts to drain the swamp, I think ecologically, when we actually literally do drain the swamps, it's about useful as it was in terms of bringing up all sorts of nasty issues. Wetlands have been the forgotten child of freshwater ecology for our freshwater ecosystem for quite a long time now. We've lost 90% of our wetlands. And as you say, they have massive, massive stores of carbon that accumulate in the bottom of those wetlands. So what happens when you've got the water over the top of the wetlands, you get a layer of anoxic where you get and that's where the carbon deposits, where you're below where you get that oxygen breakdown. When we drain those wetlands...
Can I just dial back a little bit there in case listeners aren't familiar with that? Are you talking of like a layering within a wetland or a lake or something? Is that what I'm understanding?
Basically, if you think of a wetland as being a sponge, and when you've got the water in the... So if you fill it up with water, the oxygen struggles to penetrate through that water, very deep through the water. So it doesn't move very fast through the water. So deeper down, as you go deeper down, there won't be any oxygen and you won't get very much decomposition. And that's where you'll get carbon accumulating.
Right, so got you.
As soon as you drain that water away and you've got the air moving in there, it pulls the oxygen in and then you can get that respiration and you can break down that carbon that's being stored there.
And that goes off possibly as methane or something. Is that how it works?
Some of it will be methane and some of it are carbon dioxide as
well. Okay. Now, that's a good, great explanation. Thank you. And it's made it clearer in my mind. Carry on now. I'm sorry to interrupt you.
So just the simple act of, especially for our peat wetlands, the simple act of just re-wetting it, just capping it with water again can make a huge difference to the carbon that's being emitted.
Wow.
Wetlands. And there is agricultural practices that can actually happen on these wetted, when you've got the water on land there. So there's a big movement, particularly in parts of Europe, towards polluticulture, which is trying to have productive land uses within wetlands. This can a common crop that grows on wetted areas is blueberries. So blueberry farms go quite well on wetted peat bogs. Mm-hmm. Also in New Zealand, harakeke for fibre or seed oil production.
Right.
So we do have these opportunities, and the wetlands that are drained present a risk to us, and it's not just a pure carbon issue as well. So wetlands provide a whole range of surfaces. The reason these areas are wet is because of where water is flowing into them, and in terms of flood mitigation, they're often extremely important buffering areas. And they are also water reservoirs for when we move water off the land very fast, don't actually have that water maybe when we need it in periods of drought. So wetlands can actually be an incredibly important way of maintaining water on our landscape or when we might be needing it later on.
Oh, fantastic. You opened by saying the forgotten child, and I can well imagine that is a good description. And certainly what you've just said has opened my eyes a bit too. Thank you so much. It's a bit of a jump from wetlands to forests, maybe not that huge a jump, but we all know that forests are a big deal among climate strategies and also a bit controversial. This fierce debate erupts just over the red tape, let alone their ecology. For example, over exotic versus indigenous, the construction sector's complex protocols around whether we recognise carbon stored in timber. Without inveigling you into the labyrinth of the emissions trading scheme, are you able to bring an ecologist's bird's eye view of the issues around exotic versus indigenous forests and where they sit in terms of both carbon storage and of regenerating nature?
As a freshwater ecologist, my main interaction with the forestry industry, or to say, is in terms of the harvest side. Mm-hmm. And when forestry is being harvested, we do know that it has pretty significant impacts on our freshwater ecosystems. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're just massively increasing the risk factor for huge sediment loss that is going to then flood down our rivers and into our lakes and estuaries. And of course, when we put another risk layer on top of that of climate change, we know that it's becoming a bigger issue. But it is a different story when we're talking about forestry for long-term carbon store, as that's, you know, when we're not talking about harvesting the forestry. I think from a freshwater perspective, it is a net gain. So I know, you know, taking an example of transitioning pasture, so what would have been formerly farmland, and mm-hmm. planting that into forestry, you will get some increased nutrient loss for a short period of time there as the trees are growing up and there's less grazing. So your grassland is very productive. Mm-hmm. So once the system sort of comes to a new equilibrium, after that point, the system is ecologically very benign, and it is, and functionally speaking, the forestry streams are very similar to our native streams. We have good riparian shading, the water is cool, and we have generally low nutrient concentrations in those streams, and they can support a wide range of native biodiversity, which is fantastic.
Now, I'm jumping around outside the freshwater ecology area, Simon, because I know that I, like many listeners, will have heard of the term blue carbon without being quite sure what it is or of its significance. And I know there's also local and global interest in the potential of kelp and other seaweeds as low methane cattle feed. To me, that conjures up a picture of coastal desecration as we strip the seaweed for stock food. Can you enlighten us a little on the significance of these areas?
So the other side of harvesting seaweed is actually there's a big push for restoring areas, and particularly I'm talking about seagrass. Seagrass, I guess you could call them they're grass meadows, and they grow in our shallow, quite low energy environment. So this is estuaries, and a prime example is in Farewell Spit. Yeah, where we get these large low gradient sand flats, mm-hmm. and there is a huge potential for the, as we call, the blue carbon in these systems. So similarly as grass we're familiar with on our lawns, seagrass, it has root mass that goes down into the sand. It holds the sand together, which reduces the sedimentation. And through that growth cycle, it's putting the root mass down into the sediment. And some of that root mass will then break down as the plant dies. Some of that root mass stays in the sediment. And that's where you get these long-term carbon sinks building up in the sediment. And that is the blue carbon that people are excited about as a potential for a carbon sink long term. The exciting aspect of the seagrass and the blue carbon is the multiple benefits that come with it. So this is the environments that we typically get seagrass are some of the most impacted ecosystems that we have within New Zealand. So these lowland, typically estuarine environments where a lot of our land use, historical land use in the catchments upstream have come out, and we get the deposition of this, of fine silts that smothers these seagrass beds. And then, so we've actually lost a lot of that habitat. And right. Not only is seagrass incredibly productive, it's also a critical ecosystem for a nursery ecosystem for fish. It's, you know, it fuels the food chains that support our fisheries. So the idea of restoring seagrass, with an economic incentive for carbon, I think is incredibly exciting, because then it's got these flow-on effects where we get to have ecosystem restoration as well, which is pretty exciting.
Oh, the classic case of co-benefits, isn't it? So if you like to go out and drop a line over the side of a boat, then you'll have a better chance of catching something if we've got really good seagrass beds, by the sound of it.
And exactly.
Yeah, wonderful.
And I'll just pick up also on the seaweeds that you were talking about. So harvesting seaweed.
Oh yeah, please.
And that is an emerging area, looking at various seaweeds that as a supplement that can be added to stock feed, particularly cattle feed, to reduce their methane belching. And so, you know, it's something that is developing, but I think it's just important to say that alongside, this is an emerging research area. It's a technology that's being researched at the moment for feasibility and viability. But this wouldn't necessarily be harvesting seaweed from the coastline. This would be developing in line with seaweed aquaculture. So this would be setting up farms to farm seaweed, I'm presuming actually somewhere, you know, offshore, so not actually on rocky reefs, but you know, setting up structures in deeper water where you'd be growing the seaweed up. So don't worry, I don't think there'll be any desecration of our seashores anytime soon.
Oh, great. That's good news. It's lovely to get a bit of good news. And it puts me in mind of the book by Tim Flannery called Sunshine and Seaweed. You may not have read it, but he was there discussing having offshore giant kelp farms, so that because of the multiple benefits that came from kelp. So I can see a bit of an echo in what you're talking about there. Well, Simon, unfortunately, we're getting to the close, but one of the great pleasures of having specialists like you on the show is that I can throw the open mic to you a little bit, if you like, and invite you to give our listeners what would be your top take-home message or messages. This is for the population generally, but also especially for listeners wanting to factor climate change and nature into the coming elections. And the listeners might be people who are going to vote, or they might be councillors who are offering themselves for election. I'd love to hear your views on that.
I think my real take-home message would be just how important local elections are. If we think of the resources that are our carbon sinks, if we think about the resources that are just all our, so many of our important ecosystems, they're all managed at the regional council level. And sometimes regional politics isn't the most exciting aspect, but I think that I would just like people to think next time you're visiting a beautiful river, next time you're looking at the sea, or next time you're appreciating the beach, just to think that your decisions and who you're voting for is what actually is driving the protection of these places. And just thinking, as harking back to what I said earlier around the climate change being a multiplier of the stresses on these environments, I think I would urge for caution in terms of environmental policies for managing our ecosystems.
That's a very clear and very powerful message to finish on, Simon. Thanks. And I really thank you for it. Well, on that note, I will say tēnā koe. Thank you very much for your contribution tonight. It's been lovely to have a conversation with you, and I really appreciate your insights.
Kia ora, Lindsay. Thank you very much.
Isn't it such a privilege to be able to hold a conversation with someone like Simon Stewart? It's just lovely to be able to tap into his incredible breadth of knowledge. Now, I always promise to give you listening options for the series People, Places and the Climate Crisis. You can listen in full to the interview with each guest on their own podcast, and these are available on Spotify and Apple and other main platforms, and can be linked from my firm's website, which is at www.resilience, that's R-E-S-I-L-I-E-N-Z, resilience.co.nz, where you can navigate easily to our podcast page. That will also give the full schedule plus background information, as well as information on Fresh FM broadcasting frequencies and to podcasts of the radio shows, with most of the interviews condensed to about half their length. As always, a big shout out to Kahu Sanson-Burnett, my invaluable sound tech and podcast whiz. And of course, a big shout out to you, our listeners. Thank you so much for joining this important discussion. We have many more fascinating experts coming up on the series, and I do hope we enjoy your company for them too. Including next up, on the same theme, regenerating nature, we have Simon Miller of Pure Advantage Green Business Organization. And Simon is really immersed in aspects of regeneration, as we'll find out. This is Lindsay Wood signing off, and as always, kia kaha for the climate.